Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Today we'll be talking with a blind software engineer I've never met before, but has sometimes been confused for me, as you'll hear later in the show.
Computers are very accessible to the visually impaired these days, and there are many attractive employment opportunities for those with computer-related skills, particularly if they know how to program. We'll speak with Tom Schultz, a blind software engineer, about his career and how he uses these skills in developing new hardware devices. But first for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Tom Schultz.
Technology has done nothing but make things easier and easier for us, right? I mean, with the OCR and with smartphones being accessible and, Pete, you know, maybe like me as a music fan, I can actually see all the songs on my music collection and control what I play either through a web interface or an iPhone. And then the OCR, and now I haven't used the Canopy Reader, but it's just miraculous how it really does keep improving our lives. And every time things go to another generation, like as the web was getting more and more graphical, we worried, well, were we going to be able to use the web in the future? But really, I mean, things just got better and better, and we can do banking and trade stocks and all these things.
Yeah, technology has really improved over the past few decades. And I think these days in many areas, blind people do have technical parity with their sighted colleagues in many areas. There are still some things that present some barriers, but they're becoming less and less.
Yes. And there's often a lag time with the new technology. But in many, many ways, it just gets better and better.
When I was going through college in the early 70s, I was still using my eyesight to do all of my work, although sometimes it was problematical. But, you know, I am just very happy that technologies started coming along later in the 70s and early 80s that enabled me to continue doing my work as my vision degraded, and it made a huge difference.
Let's start by meeting Tom Schultz and learning about his background, including that funny coincidence between him and Pete that Pete alluded to earlier.
I'm Tom Schultz, and I'm, we used to say, a firmware engineer, but nowadays people like to say embedded software engineer. I started work doing firmware initially while I was in college as an electrical engineer, and then I was actually losing my sight and very concerned about being able to work as an electrical engineer successfully, but I had started getting involved in microprocessors and programming. I started college in 1978, and my microprocessor stuff came along around 1980 in college for me. So I realized that the programming would be a much more viable thing for me to do without any vision at all.
You said you've been first a student and then a professional with varying degrees of vision loss. What adaptive technologies have you used?
At the time I had low vision, you know, there were large screen terminals, which I used. And then as when I, you know, really lost the last of my sight just a few years later, 1984, that was right when speech synthesizers were kind of popping up. So I did make the change into using a screen reader with voice output. My braille reading skills are okay, but not enough to be productive at work. I think that's kind of common for people that lose sight later in life.
As it is for me, I mean, I read braille sometimes to keep in practice, but I mostly use it for taking short notes like phone numbers or labeling the microwave. But in general, some of the speech technologies and other access type of technologies are a lot more efficient.
Where have you worked?
I worked for Xerox for 16 years and then Ingersoll Rand for maybe 12 years. Since then, I've been doing consulting and I'm really still writing programs for embedded systems, but I kind of go from client to client.
So I understand that when you were at Xerox, and coincidentally Pete was at Xerox doing mostly programming, but on the East Coast, you had some interesting interactions.
Well, I knew of Pete because people would commonly be out in Fremont, California, where I worked, and say, "Hey, Pete, I didn't know you moved to California." As it happens, my middle name's Pete. But so someone from back east, there's this really bright engineer named Pete who works in Webster. And I never met you at the time, but I knew of you.
Well, Xerox is a big company and spread around the world. And when you're talking about tens of thousands of workers, it's tough to know everybody. But that was an interesting connection that you made us aware of in an email note to us a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And of course, you look nothing alike. But how many bright, blind software engineers could there have been at this corporation? And the answer was at least two.
Well, and sadly, it may not have been much more than that. I mean, that's really the things have improved a bit, but, you know, there weren't that many blind people working in many of these jobs. It's only gotten better.
And the moral is, not every blind programmer is named Pete.
And the other moral is, there's plenty of room for additional blind programmers, and we hope that if you're interested in becoming one, listening to what Tom has to say will encourage you that it's actually feasible.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is what it's like being a blind software engineer.
One of the reasons we talk with people like yourself on Eyes on Success is to show other blind individuals around the world what really is possible and open up people's minds about what opportunities there are for blind people and that, you know, some of these barriers can be overcome. Can you talk about when you started to lose your vision, how you made that transition and what some of the difficulties were?
Yeah, I think that I was never a really good advocate for myself, so it made it rather challenging. I remember as I was losing my vision, one of the challenges that anybody who's going through it has is that every time I would come up with accommodations to do things with my worsening eyesight, then they wouldn't work anymore. You know, the magnifying glass wasn't strong enough, or the dark pens that I liked weren't dark enough. And it was, in some way, when I finally lost my sight, at least things weren't getting any worse anymore. It was kind of there. But usually, as I'm sure you know, people that have some sight usually try to maximize everything they can do with it. And then it's almost a different disability when you have no sight that you have to do things without it at all.
Yeah, it's an interesting transition. I remember making that transition myself. I mean, I would first use closed-circuit TV systems with print with a lot of contrast and very large. And then as my eyesight degraded a bit more, I would start to complement that with speech synthesizers. And then, you know, as my eyesight deteriorated still further, I started using Braille displays. And so it really is a transition process, and you have to be open to learning new technologies, new ways of doing things.
Yeah.
I guess we both went through similar transitions and dealt with it ourselves, but maybe you can tell us how the people around you, your coworkers, your peers, dealt with it during your transition.
It was a really neat thing when I left college and started my first job that, you know, unlike school where you're sort of being challenged by a teacher all the time, a manager in a job is total opposite. They want to make you successful. And I found that they were very cooperative and in people at work and my boss in making suggestions and helping me with things.
Can you mention some specific examples of the kinds of support you've gotten?
I remember when Xerox first announced that Reading Edge OCR machine, I didn't know about it. And my boss came running down to my office with, you know, the announcement and said, "Hey, why don't we order one of these for you?" You know, as long as you've got a good attitude, you'll find that people at work, you know, they want to help you out. They'll come to you with things that they've learned about. And it's warm and rewarding when you have that kind of a relationship.
Well, that was my experience also. And I think also working for a major corporation like Xerox, you know, they had the money so that if they needed to buy a $3,000 or $4,000 reading machine, it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah.
So, you know, any equipment that I needed was always available to me if I just identified what my needs were and, you know, express the desire.
I've had that positive things from, you know, in one case of a really small employer. I remember the president of the company called me into his office after, you know, he had talked to everybody. They knew they were going to interview him. They were going to probably hire me. And he said, you know, whatever you need, we'll get it for you, you know. So I think you're right that big companies often do it as a rule, but you'll actually find some very positive things from small companies too. And then for people that are in a situation where they do need help with expenses and the work won't do it and they can't do it, then there's the Department of Rehabilitation that can help with costs as well.
We are fortunate in the United States that we have those types of services.
Well, and one thing to remember about getting the kind of adaptive equipment you need is that if you ask for it, as Pete and Tom have said, odds are pretty good you'll get a positive response. But don't expect your boss to know anything about adaptive technology. It's going to be up to you to keep on top of the field and know what your needs are and what equipment is available to help with your needs.
I'm wondering what the process was like when you interviewed for the job. Was there any reluctance to hire a blind person?
Just speaking generally, I've had all kinds of experiences. And some of the bad experiences, I don't know, I wonder if being blind is a blessing because you learn really quick if people, maybe it's not a nice place to work. And I always feel when people are going to be accepting of you and give you a break, and, you know, maybe be able to think a little out of the box, hey, maybe that's a better place to work. So it can be rather punishing and challenging and humiliating when you're interviewing. But in the end, when you land a job, you know, may very well be a very rewarding place to work. And that's kind of been my experience. And it still is.
You've actually started new jobs several times. And we've spoken with several other blind people about their opinion of when during the job application process you reveal to the prospective employer that you've got a visual impairment. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I have done both. As a rule, I used to never say anything and just show up. And that surprises some people. And maybe rehabilitation counselors say you should never do that. I always worried, though, that then before the interview, they're just going to sit around and think about a million reasons not to hire you. And maybe it'd be better to just go in and advocate for yourself person to person. But more recently, since I've been consulting, I've tried the other approach and told them in advance, and that worked out as well. So I don't know. That's my experience on it.
My guess is it's more difficult the first time. Once you've established a successful track record that you can show to people, it's a lot easier for them to overcome their own reticence that they might have in hiring a visually impaired person.
I think that's somewhat true. I think that first job is the hardest. It's going to be the case, and it is for everybody, blind or not, probably interviewing jobs. You have good job interviews and bad. You just got to be persistent and keep going through it.
There's nothing like persistence and being your own advocate.
On that topic of being your own advocate, you said that you were in college when your vision began to fail. So I assume that you weren't any longer living with your parents and having them coach you through developing the ability to advocate for yourself. And you were also probably aged out of any of the state support systems where a lot of high school and younger students get a teacher of the visually impaired to help them out and find out what's available. Did you get any kind of help from somebody at the college to coach you into advocating for yourself? How did that play out?
As an undergraduate, no, I really had nothing. And I don't know if they had an office for disabled students like colleges do today. But I did get all the way through undergraduate. Then as a graduate student, I did learn about the Office for Disabled Students, and they were able to advocate somewhat for me with some teachers. Like there was one teacher who just let me have his notes so I could see all the problems that he was working on the board.
These days, it's standard practice for the professors to generate their notes as a PowerPoint presentation, and everybody gets it.
Now, I always made sure to talk to my professors before the beginning of the class year about, you know, how we could work together to make it all be a success, either in terms of trading notes or speaking what they wrote on the board, et cetera. And that seemed to work pretty well.
Well, I think that's great advice, because that sort of advocacy for yourself is something you need to do, and I should have done a better job of it when I was younger.
For people thinking of one of these engineering fields, you described yourself as working in firmware and embedded systems. Some people may not know what that is or what you do on a daily basis. Can you give a quick overview of what the job involves and what those words mean?
I guess the easiest summation is you're a programmer. The embedded systems refers to devices that have a microprocessor embedded inside them, and they're usually doing a singular function, like operate in a microwave or a TV. I mean, so many of these electronic gadgets we have today have a microprocessor inside of them. So it's as opposed to a personal computer or a mainframe computer that has all different applications loaded on them.
You mentioned that you do a lot of consulting these days, and I suppose writing software is particularly amenable to that, since you can do this all remotely if you like.
It depends on the project, and I have had quite a bit of projects where I was working at home. Right now, I've got a small security device sitting here next to me hooked up to my debugger, and I've been working home quite a bit. But when I was some of the printers I've worked on are rather large and big, and you basically have to be at work. And you need to also be at work to connect to other members of the team. Embedded software engineers, they don't do the electrical design, but they need to understand electronics. And so I'm frequently working with electrical engineers. And then in cases sometimes where there's a trouble with a prototype you're working on, you need to work together with an electrical engineer using an oscilloscope that I wouldn't be able to use, and me doing the programming to find problems and complete your design.
Lots of work is done in teams these days, since no one person has all the knowledge or skills or time available, so it's easier to parse out the work in terms of what's easy for you to do and what's easy for them to do and to cooperate.
I think that's true at a lot of jobs, too. They find where each member of the team has skills and aptitudes and even interests, and so there's a lot of work to be done, and things get parceled out with that in mind.
So I assume, as a programmer over the course of the last few decades, that you've had to work in numerous programming languages and numerous operating systems. What resources did you have that you could use for learning each new language or operating system?
Well, that's a great question, and it goes back to what we were talking about, where technology just makes things easier and easier for us. I remember years ago asking Recording for the Blind, when they were putting things out on cassette tape, to record an Intel microcontroller manual for me. You know, God bless all those readers, but it took months to do. And sometimes I would ask a friend or coworker, you know, to read something while I took notes, maybe instructions in a language or something. Whereas today, I get everything on PDF or on the internet, and it's so much easier, because for an embedded software engineer, there is a lot of learning. Every time you go to a new project, there might be a new microcontroller you're working with. Could be a new language. There's a new debugger you have to learn. There's a new compiler, a new integrated development environment. So there is a lot of learning for an embedded engineer as you go from project to project. And it's so much easier to do today. I remember years ago using a particular proprietary operating system, and they didn't. This was just before things were available in PDF form, and I contacted people in the company, and they were actually willing to have their tech writer give me his source files for the manuals. They were in Frame, I think, and then someone where I worked who had Frame was able to convert them to text for me. So I used to have to go through a lot of work, you know, from Recording for the Blind to signing a non-disclosure with some tech writer to get these things done, whereas now everything is just so readily accessible.
I guess the only thing that might still be a bit problematic is diagrams, flowcharts, or electrical diagrams in your particular field.
Yes, and it is interesting that some manuals rely very heavily on diagrams, and others have a lot more language to them. And the diagrams, you know, in some cases, I do have to have someone look at them and tell me what's in them. But more often than not, I'm able to get by even with a poor data sheet and some sample code, you know, which is always, of course, in text form.
And again, the cooperation within the team where everybody wants to succeed, I assume, motivates your coworkers to be perfectly willing to be your eyeballs when necessary to describe and or interpret whatever diagrams and figures you can't capture yourself.
Yes, that's true. Or even to just come over and help me with some little wiring thing that seems to have gone wrong and I can't figure out how to fix it on a prototype that's sitting on my desk. It was a little funny story, but I started this consulting job I'm working on now last summer. And a guy a few offices down from me, the hardware guys were all out of the building, and I was sure that this wire had come off, and I needed him to read a wiring diagram and hook it back up for me. So I called this nice fellow who came over, and as he's doing, he told me he's involved in training. He's not actually an electronic person at all, but he was doing his best to figure it out. He's a friendly person. But, you know, when people see that you've got a positive and friendly outgoing demeanor, it brings out the best in them. And the people, you know, they all do want to help one another in most job environments that I've been fortunate to be in.
You know, I must say, for my last 15 years at Xerox, I worked in an image processing area and eventually went on to manage the team that was responsible for print quality and image processing. And, you know, you talk about relying on the feedback from others, and, you know, everybody was always willing and able to do that. And we worked as a team together. It wasn't a big deal that I couldn't see the images that we were supposed to make prettier. And it was almost a positive thing for the rest of the team because it really made them verbalize what they were seeing and share those thoughts with others in a way that they normally wouldn't. So, you know, these things can work many ways, and depending on your attitude, as you say.
That is a really interesting story, and I have a very similar one at Xerox. When I was working on commercial graphics printers, they print in four passes with the black, cyan, magenta, and yellow, and somehow I fell into becoming the print registration expert. The guy responsible. So just like you can imagine, I had to call people over occasionally. I would try to monitor how things were going by looking at sensor readings, but ultimately I needed them to come over and help me. And people were willing to come over and look at a test image and tell me what they were seeing. Just like you, that's such an identical story, Pete.
Yeah, it's very similar. Just shows you what's possible if people have open minds and are willing to, you know, do what it takes to overcome some challenges.
Yeah, and I think for probably both of us, as we talked to friends about what we did, it probably did seem ironic that these two blind guys were working on printers.
That was kind of a funny story around Xerox.
Uh-huh.
Well, and at one point, oh my gosh, 15 or 20 years ago, somebody at Xerox figured out that this would make for some good press, that they had a blind guy doing image quality work and image processing. And Pete got interviewed by all sorts of people. And he was in the local television and the local newspaper and Time Digital and CNN-FN and on and on and on. And, you know, everybody was just scratching their heads like, how does this blind guy manage to do this kind of work?
Wow.
But I think they just weren't very creative. You know, I think blind people are capable of an awful lot more than most sighted people can imagine.
I think that's true, yeah. And guys like Pete go and show them that, which is a good thing, which is why we're doing this interview.
That's right. And hopefully other people will get the idea that these things really are possible. There are some exciting, fun, and interesting jobs out there to be had.
There really are. And it's just amazing how the technology jobs, but legal jobs, so many different jobs have really opened up in the last years for blind people that they can do. It's a tremendous thing. It seems like once upon a time, you know, piano tuner, and, you know, it wasn't that long ago, right? And yet today, you just find blind people doing all kinds of things.
That is true.
Now for this week's final item, how to reach Tom Schultz, and also pointers to other resources for anybody considering a career in computers.
So if people wanted to contact you if they had questions, would they be able to do that?
They could send me an email. My email, it's, I'll say it first, but then I'll spell it. It's tomschultzesp@gmail.com. It's T-O-M for Tom. Schultz is spelled S-H-U-L-T-S. And ESP is for Embedded Systems Programmer at gmail.com.
So you use that address for your consulting, I guess.
I do, yeah.
Are you in LinkedIn?
Yep, I'm on LinkedIn. You could probably find me, Tom Schultz, S-H-U-L-T-S.
Yeah, it turns out there are actually many Tom Schultz spelled that way, and even more spelled differently on LinkedIn. So we will post the direct link to the correct Tom Schultz at LinkedIn in the show notes for this show. Do you know of any particular resources that you would direct somebody to who's interested in getting into a computer engineering type of job?
A good thing to do is to go to any of these agencies that work with helping coach blind people into careers, and then ask them if they have someone they've worked with that they could contact. But a good thing for a young person to do that I found it very rewarding is to talk to people who are out there working. Then you can ask them directed questions, as we've been doing here. And that's what I did when I was just leaving college, is some organizations, Sensory Access Foundation, they work with a lot of various professionals that are trying to get into employment opportunities. And they gave me names of people they worked with. And I found a lot of people like myself that were really happy to talk to someone that was interested in a particular career. And since I've had that happen to me as well, some of those organizations have said, hey, can we give your name out, you know, for someone? And I've said, sure. And people call me up and I talk to them about what I do. I think that's a great resource.
And an excellent organization for helping you make those connections is the American Foundation for the Blind's Career Connect service. We will put a link to that in our show notes, and you'll be able to connect with professionals like Tom and myself who are in your field of interest. And our show notes, which will contain that information along with all the other contact information and resources you hear about in our shows, can be found at www.eyesonsuccess.net.
That's it for show number 1714. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking with Martha Harmon Party. There's a very good chance you've heard her voice before on a talking book from the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, because she has narrated over 3,000 of them. Yes, you heard that correctly. And we will talk with her about the process of recording audiobooks, notable moments in her career, and what else she does as a professional voice artist. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-210-8094.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. Browse the full archive of programs, find instructions for subscribing to the podcasts, and much more at www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also find us on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com, at Eyes on Success, or Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.